Occasionally and often, the messages on a given Sabbath, in fact, the announcements, have a kind of similarity to them. And whereas we don't, I promise you, we don't speak with one another before we speak, hopefully it says that those that address you are somewhat on the same wavelength to some degree, one or another. Now, I saw Mr. Grinnell's notes from afar. The title of it, right? You didn't mention the title, did you? Can I tell him? He entitled it Dear Abby. You don't mind me doing that. Your notes were by the Spanish language. That's what it was. A few weeks ago, I was preparing for this message, the message for today, and I'd wanted to give you. And I was down in San Diego, and the title of that message was The Weightier Matters. And a couple of those aspects were brought up in Mr. Grinnell's message, and were brought up, in fact, you may have noticed in the prayer. And if you didn't, we're going to hit him again a little later today. But the section I'd intended was on Matthew 23. And you'll remember that section in Matthew 23 of, woe to you scribes, Pharisees. Help me out. A little louder, it's okay. Hypocrites. You're not going to get asked very often for audience response, but that's one of them. Woe to you scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. He does this seven times. And it seems a little bit on the negative side. But inside of Matthew 23, which we will not be doing today, inside it has a core of great purpose, and it has to do with the weightier matters, things they'd ignored in those words that you heard in the prayer, and in Mr. Grinnell's message was justice and mercy. Justice and mercy. I reviewed that message, and it had to do basically with, I'd been asked to do a small paper on tithing. And Matthew 23 is one of the few verses that explicitly and then confirms the concept of the law of tithing, which we teach. It's important, it's required, but we should never, ever ignore the weightier matters of the law. But I'm not going to give that. But I give something close, and you get one guess as to which book it's in. You're right, Matthew. And so the topic today is related, but it has to do, again, with the law and the prophets. But to get there, we're going to need to go through some interesting stuff, I would like to think. In fact, this section has got some of the most famous or oft-repeated verses in the entire Bible. And they're all in one place. And I've entitled this Seeing Clearly. So if you want a title, it's called Seeing Clearly. Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew chapter 7. And again, this is a very interesting section. And it has a tremendous amount of structure to what we're going to be reading. You're going to hear the word chiasm. And a chiasm is a reverse structure, which means it's about three or four verses usually, and there's three or four of them in this section, where it starts out with subject A, moves to subject B, hits a central point, then moves back to subject B, and then back to subject A. It's a very well-formed point, and it has what we call a chiastic or cross structure in terms of it has a central point, builds up to it, then backs away from it. I like stuff like that. Why? Because it shows there was great intent by the writer to put it in. He's trying to build a point. He brings up the point, hits the point, and moves away from it. And it begins in chapter 7. It has this style. And remember, the Pharisees were told, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. And so in chapter 7, verse 1, he says, a very famous verse, I think you would agree, judge not that you be not judged. And that's a very compelling statement. Judge not. I've had that heard people say that. Once in a blue moon, it was to me. Don't judge. Don't judge. That you be not judged. But the context is incredibly important. As we read and we listen, Christ tells us to do things and not to do other things. And you'll see this over and over again. He says this only once. He says this once, you're not to judge. Because if you do, you will be judged. Now, the word krino is the stem word for the word judge. And there's cognates of it, of katakrino, which means the judgment, which has to do with law. Krino is used over and over again, and more so in this chapter than any other in the New Testament. But it is a warning. He says, be warned. If you judge, it's a conditional statement. If you judge, then, if then, you will be judged. The commentaries are divided as to the strength of the term. But with perspective, they all say it's very, very plain. The simplicity of it is to not to discern and to make a value judgment, which is acceptable. The complex is to sit as a judge, to sit as the prosecution and a judge, deciding what is right and what is wrong for another person. Does God want us to make right and wrong decisions? He absolutely does. He says, choose now, decide. We're to evaluate and we're to choose. You can call a judge because that is a word you can use. Can we make these value judgments on a relative basis? Yes. Yes, we can, and we do. Let me give you an example. If you were to say, I don't like that suit. It makes you look fat. Now, I'm not going to ask by a raise of hands how many people have heard that or said it. If I say, I don't like that suit, it makes you look fat, is that a permissible statement? Absolutely it is. It's very permissible, especially if it's true. However, it's only acceptable and understandable if you're talking to yourself and you're looking in a mirror. If you say it to your spouse or someone else, that's not very smart. It may be true, it may not be smart. Paul says all things may be lawful, but not all things are expedient. In other words, watch what you say. But you can make that judgment call. You could also say in a value judgment, I don't watch these particular TV shows or movies. They project bad values, things I really don't believe in. You could say that, and you'd make a judgment call. You may say, I can't go there. I don't want to do this. I don't want to be there because this is not a very good place for me to be. For me, I can't be there. It's not acceptable. That's very permissible value judgment. You may say those values are not in accord with my views as I understand God's law. They're just not in accord. I made a value judgment, and it was a judgment indeed. You may also say, oh, Roger, he's such a dummy. Roger's a dummy. You could say that. Was it mean? Well, somebody like me who has a fair amount of sarcasm, possibly too much, no, it's not offensive. To other people, it could be very offensive, but it's still, it's a value judgment. But it could be considered a little bit lighthearted. What about Roger? He's headed for Gehenna if he continues in what he's doing. He will be in danger of the judgment if he continues. Mary? Mary, she's an evil person. Very evil. That's what I think. Or you may say, that church, they're apostate. They are apostate. They have all lost their salvation. Those are not acceptable statements. And I'll explain why. And hopefully you can understand why. Because they are very, very different. There's judgment and judging, then there's judgment and judging. The reasons are three, and there could be more. Wrong basis or degree. Number two, it is the wrong person involved. Wrong person involved. And number three, wrong perspective. Verse 2 says, we're only into verse 1. Verse 2 says, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. The word is in almost staccato. The three Greek words are used in rapid succession. What judgment you judge, you will be judged. What judgment that you judge, you will be judged. It's very similar to what we call the lex talionis, which means the law of retribution. In the Bible, it's known as an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. In certain matters of law, many Middle East laws, however you intended falsely to hurt someone, or whatever you have accused them of, and whatever the penalty was, could be the cutting off of the hand, cutting out of the tongue, death, certain type of death. Lex talionis says, that's how, once you're found out that you're wrong, the penalty that you would have on that person, you will endure. That's the punishment you will have. I don't know. I don't know if that helps us today. But what judgment you judge, you will be judged. Whatever you intended to inflict will be inflicted on you. And I think sometimes we believe that, and we understand it very well. If I say this, am I guilty of it? But it goes deeper. It says here that you will be judged with measure. Now, there's an inference here of judged by whom? How? The inference is the whom will be carried out by God. You will be judged. It's a very final, exclamatory remark. You will be judged. And it's not by your friends and neighbors. It's by God. That's the inference. Now, we're two verses in, and you may be thinking, does this mean I can't make value judgments against lifestyles or beliefs that I don't find are acceptable, that I don't believe in or accord with God's law? Do we have to agree? Can we not make a value judgment on homosexuality as a lifestyle? Can we not make a value judgment, a strong value judgment on the sanctity of marriage? Yes, we can. But that isn't the focus here. And to focus that here is the wrong perspective, wrong degree, and wrong person, as we'll see. It isn't the focus of Jesus' words. Let's read verses 3 through 5 and get an even deeper understanding. Now, you'll understand why this is up here. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank, translated the beam, in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite. First remove the beam from your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. There is so much structure here. You'll see how it moves in, and it says, how can you say to your brother, take the speck, it moves to your own eye. It says, what's the center point of this, what we call this chiasmus? Hypocrite. There was one group of people in the New Testament more than any other that Jesus labeled as hypocrite. The scribes and the Pharisees. Scribes, Pharisees, hypocrite, blind guides, he calls them. Matthew 23 reference there. Blind guides, they are hypocrites. He says then to take out the plank of your own eye and you'll be able to see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. I believe, this is probably the way I think, and maybe you agree, maybe you don't agree, I think there's a little bit of sarcasm here, and I'll show you why. Because Jesus talks about the minors and the majors. He uses small things and great things. Now, I had a toothpick here, and it was so small. I'm not kidding. I had it here. I was going to show you a toothpick. I lost it. It's so small. It was my idea of the speck. You get one guess. If the toothpick was the speck in your brother's eye, you get one guess with the analogy I have for the beam in somebody else's eye. I couldn't get anything bigger because Becky wouldn't have been able to be in the car with me. You found my toothpick. Where did you find my toothpick? Oh, where I was sitting. This has not been used. So here's the toothpick. Thank you very much, Manfred. So you found the toothpick in my eye. No, in my... So you see the analogy. It's very, very clear. Let's look at them comparatively. Wow. I started to say before Manfred came up, I was going to try and get a bigger beam from home, but Becky wouldn't have been able to fit in the car, or I wouldn't have been able to fit in the car, and she'd have had to drive it up here. This is the biggest one I could get. And so we see this comparison. It says, the center here is hypocrisy. How can you say to someone else about their problem when you may have the same problem or that person has the same problem? How can you say to someone what they're guilty of? Moreover, you are looking into someone's eye for this speck. Now, I want you to picture the visual because I think Jesus intended the visual. Can you imagine somebody peering into your eye to look for something in your eye? Right? It's a little too close, by the way, unless you know the person very well. They're very, very close. There, you are looking in someone else's eye for the speck of wood, this sawdust. I'd hate to have that toothpick in my eye, or a piece of wood. And when you're doing that, while you're looking into this other person's eye, you've got a part of Home Depot's lumberyard in your eye. I think Jesus meant that analogy. It's this incredibly odd illusion or visual. And so you've got part of Home Depot's lumberyard in your eye. They have a speck. We put it in 21st century parlance. You have sawdust in your eye, and they have a 6x6, 16-foot structural beam, a support beam in their eye, the person doing the accusing, the person doing the looking. First of all, the Greek word here, when it says beam or it says log that you read here, it's the word dokhan, which means a supporting roof joist. I want you to look up in this building. We couldn't ask for a better building. And by the way, we've only got 3 Sabbaths to go here, so take a good look at the roof. It's a beautiful roof. I was thinking about this. You see these beams? These are structural support beams. Look at the ones that cut across this room. The analogy is plain. He makes it for a reason. The person doing the inspecting has got one of these in their eye. It's absurd. They squint because they have a speck in their eye. The person looking with the beam in their eye is absolutely, utterly, and completely, I won't hold this up, they're blind. They're absolutely blind. They can't see. First of all, they can't see the speck in the other person's eye because they can't see because of what's in their eye. Does Jesus say it's okay to ask a contractor to help remove the beam? Because that's what you're going to need for this piece of, or an ophthalmologist. By the way, the word in the Greek here is where we get the word ophthalmology. It's ophthalmos, which is the Greek word for eye. He says, does he say it's okay to once get the beam out? Once you get the beam out, then go ahead and dig into somebody else's eye. I think if you say yes to that, you missed the point. Why would you have missed the point? Who is this person, first of all, who has the speck in their eye in relation to us? It's your brother. It's not speaking of the sins of the nation, the sins of an individual and a government or a society. It's your brother. It's very clean. Anthropos. It's your brother. This is someone that you fellowship with or have some concord with in terms of what you believe. It is your brother. And it's easy, very easy, isn't it, to trash someone or something. That's easy. And we make remarks. I make remarks. I probably shouldn't many times. Oh, he's a dummy. He's a dodo brain. And I probably shouldn't do it. But I think it is far, far worse to judgmentally condemn a brother, to condemn them. How do we condemn them? What we do is we are the wrong person to do so. We are the wrong person because when we set ourselves up as judge, jury, and executioner and sentencer, we become the judge when we say things like, I'm not very sure if they were ever converted. Or if it is said, I don't think they ever had God's Spirit. That's right. I don't know. I don't know and I will never know. I have no way of knowing. You say by their fruits. I still don't know. It gives us an indication, but it does not give us the warrant. It does not give us the justification, any of us. It does not give me the justification to tell that person that they are unspiritual, that they are headed for Gehenna, or that they are in staring into the abyss. It basically says that we need to please get out of God's chair. It is perfectly acceptable to point out sin and wrongdoing, but Christ gives us a command in verse 5. It's very interesting. First he says, remove this thing, this beam. First remove it. Well, that's easy. That's easy. If it was so easy for you to remove the beam, why is the beam still in my eye? Right? If it's so easy to take away, why is it there? Because it isn't easy. How long has the beam been there? Do I need help to take it out? What composes the beam? What's the beam made out of? Well, this one's made out of wood, some paint on it. There's quite a few nails. Yeah, a couple of nails. I hope I didn't put this on the seat. What's it made out of? The beam isn't a beam, by the way. It's not a piece of wood. The beam is sin. It says to take the beam, equal sign sin, out of your eye, and it's not your eye, it's you and me. It says to take that out first. It also tells us that indeed who the sinful party is. When we look at the focus of these verses, judge not, lest you be judged. Then you will be judged. Take the beam out of your eye. Who's the focus here? The focus in each of these verses is one person and one person only. It's me. It's me. Jesus is talking to the singular person. It's me. I'm supposed to get the beam out of my eye. I'm not supposed to judge, or I will be judged by the judgment that I create. So he says, first remove the plank. Get rid of the plank. How long does it take to get the plank out of your eye, the beam out of your eye? Well, if the beam does serve as sin, I'll speak to myself, a lifetime. I think the beam and all its splinters will finally be removed, may the Lord will, in the resurrection. Probably not before then, because we're sinful. I'm sinful. So how long will it take to get it out? Probably a lifetime. And his use of imagery is important. It's very visual. I don't know if he moved his hands around and said, you know, a speck, and then he said a beam. We don't know exactly where he may have been standing. In fact, this is given both in Matthew and in Luke. Luke said a little differently. Matthew's a little bit more complete. Roger Boyce said in a commentary, I still remember being at summer camp as a kid with the church and seeing this guy walk down the aisle with a long beam sticking out of his eye. He was walking up and down the aisle telling people that he could see specks in their eyes and that it was dangerous and they should be removed. The beam protruding out of his eye was hitting people in the face as he was trying to point out their small speck. How silly that man looked. Everyone laughed. Everyone laughed at him. But it left a burning imprint on my mind. And the reason was, once the beam has been acknowledged in my eye, Jesus says very clearly, once you've taken it out in verse 5, then you'll see clearly, and then you can start removing specks from other people's eyes. So once I get rid of the beam in my eye, I am now qualified, Jesus said, to speck pick, or pick specks. Out of your eyes. I'm qualified now, if I could say it. And so this visual that he gives us is very, very important. He can see clearly now, and one of the things that we see very clearly in this very simple analogy, in this very important chapter, is we see us. It says that we see us. I get to see me. But the Bible teaches balance. Doesn't the Bible tell us that we can make judgment decisions? Absolutely. When we see sin, what should we do? Allow it? Let it go? Hold your hand in Matthew chapter 7. Matthew 18 is where we could go, but we're going to go to Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6 is much simpler, much more straightforward. And I think a lot more realistic in terms of its ability to be applied. Chapter 6 of Galatians, verse 1. Brethren, if a man, some of them may say brother, if a man is overtaken in any trespass or sin, you who are spiritual, restore such a one. Notice how. How are you to restore this person to spiritual health, to good health, when you see them overtaken in a sin, a trespass? Such a one in a spirit of gentleness. And why? We consider the beam. Considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Bear one another's burden, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But let each one examine his own work, and then he will have rejoicing in himself alone, and not in another. For each one shall bear his own load. He says, indeed, when you see sin, you need to lovingly, caringly, privately go to that person as a brother, showing great love, great mercy, and justice, and go to that person and speak with them. But we also consider ourselves. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 7, please. So the Bible teaches balance. But there's even more here. Because judging in Matthew 7 is specific and it's focused. It's focused on the brethren, on the people that we know and the people that we love, the people that we fellowship with, the people that we believe with. And judging, it says, we should not ever do of a brother or a sister. Verse 6 is interpreted many ways. This is the tough scripture here. Verse 6 says, do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces. This can be taken many, many different ways. And I consulted a number of sources. I looked at it. What could I possibly interpret out of this? I use it as the dogs and hogs, by the way, verse, my paraphrase. Both are unclean animals. In Jewish society, dogs were not household pets. They didn't have Fido or Fluffy or whatever in the house. They were usually wild animals and were treated as such outside the house. Hogs, for obvious reasons, they were also unclean, and you didn't see too many Jewish farms or households with their pet pig. They were something to be avoided. And Jesus uses this context. He says, don't give holy to unholy. What's interesting about this verse, it says, don't waste your time. I'm wondering if it just means don't waste your time. Their mind isn't there. They don't care. They're hostile. Hostile. And don't waste your breath. Don't waste their time. It also is interesting, it's just a side note, it may be a reference, strangely enough, it supports, I think, the law of clean and unclean, of the holy and unholy, to keep them separate. The clean and the unclean you're supposed to keep separate. And so we consider what we believe and what we understand to be as pearls, the pearls of great price, the knowledge that we have deep inside each and every one of us. But let's go on. Verse 7. Here, again, is a very famous set of verses, and it forms another structure, very highly defined structure, and you'll see the words repeat over and over again. Verse 7, and ask, and it will be given to you, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds. And to him who knocks, it will be opened. Or what man or father is there among you who, if his son or daughter asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, he will give him a serpent. If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven, who is in heaven, give good things to those who ask him? It's done in a relative position. In other words, it's talking about on a human side, and many of us are fathers. All of us at one time or another have been a son or a daughter, everyone in this room. What father, and it's speaking to those that have common sense, what father or mother, what parent would not give good things to their children when they asked for them? There are many times, as we know, and again, common sense is in play here, we know that children will ask for things that they don't really need and probably shouldn't have. It's not appropriate for them, or a lot of different reasons. But the parent, common sense again, the parent knows what is good for the child. Don't we? We have two grandchildren. I'm going to spend the next 15, 20 minutes talking about both those grandchildren. I'm kidding. I was giving a presentation recently in San Diego, and we were talking about beneficiaries, and I was, telling them, extolling them on the virtues of making sure that they had beneficiaries, because our studies had found that after you're dead, and we've proven this with our studies, after you're dead, it's almost impossible to change your beneficiaries. I got the same half reaction from them. And then I said, make sure that your loved ones, your children and your grandchildren. I said, I have a new grandchild. And I asked the group, I don't know, it was 100 people. And I said, how many of you have grandchildren? 90% of them raised their hand on grandchildren. 90%. And I said, how about we stop with this presentation I have for you, and we talk about grandchildren. They all applauded. Because grandchildren, our children and our grandchildren, are they not? They're so special to us. They're so very, very special. If you haven't had grandchildren yet, we were talking before services. I was talking with the Y-Bloods, and I said, Grandchildren are very, very special. It's too hard to explain. Too hard for you to understand if you have never had them. They are a joy beyond belief, as are our children. And isn't there a parent or grandparent or great-grandparent who wouldn't want to give what they felt were good things to their grandchildren and children? It's a ridiculous question. It's an absurd question, of course. Why is the question even asked? And this is what Jesus is saying. And then he says, verse 11, if you, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, your grandchildren, how much more, very famous phrase, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? I'm a carnal, very carnal, human parent. I make lots of mistakes. I gave my kids stuff they shouldn't have had. Usually desserts or things when I was told not to give it to them. But we're carnal. We gave them things that probably weren't good for them. Let them see things that probably weren't the best things for them to see. Taught them things. Becky was Abigail. I was Nabal, right? Taught them things that probably were better left unsaid or unread. We're physical, but God isn't. God isn't physical. God is spiritual. He is all-knowing. He is omnipotent. He's omniscient. And with that, Jesus says, he will give you what you need. What's interesting is the verses he uses here, and it does connect back to the judging and do not judge. He uses fish and loaves, fish and bread. Isn't that interesting? You'll remember in Matthew, Luke, John, all the Gospels, it talks about the feeding of the 4,000, the feeding of the 5,000, what they feed them with, usually bread and fish. They were very basic, very, very necessary food items. And so he uses these examples. He says that God will give us, God in heaven, will give you the things that you need. He will supply the things that you truly and really need. And he does, doesn't he? He does give us the things that we need. He gives us the basics that we know he knows we need, both physically and spiritually. He gives his people who seek him all that they need. In fact, I counted the Psalms that we sang today. That's exactly what we sang about. Is God supplies us the things we need. We don't need, though we may want, Lamborghinis, PlayStation 4, and we just have to have that 70-inch flat screen. Those aren't included, at least not here in Matthew. The funny part was I need to confess to you on the way to church, on the 210, there was a brand new lime green, beautiful Lamborghini. I kid you not. And Becky said, what are you doing? I said, I want to see it. She said, why? So I got a little I got a little too close, but to the car. Then it took off at about Mach 5 on the 210. They're a beautiful car. I did not lust. I did not pray for one. Well, kinda, sorta. That's not what God wants to give us. God wants us to give us the fish and the loaves and the things that we need so that we don't want. But it all centers back to just exactly what is it you want in your life? What do I want in my life? What do you wish? Let's read verse 12 because that's exactly what he addresses as he caps off this section about judging and about people. Verse 12, it's here, believe it or not, this very extremely famous verse. Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. What is it that you wish? What is it that you want? People want to be treated a certain way, don't they? I do. I would think you do too. We want to be treated with kindness and gentleness and love and mercy, especially among the brethren. And I think we do to a great degree. And you can see in some of the prayer requests and the things that the elders at least see, how many of you serve in so many different capacities quietly, consistently, and effectively. We do. We all want certain things in life. This is indeed the golden rule. It's indeed the golden rule. It's rather logical. How do you want people, especially the brethren, to treat you? Sounds a little selfish, doesn't it? No, it's important because it is logical. But it's also reciprocal. It's based on God's law. This phrase, the law and the prophets, are used over and over again in the New Testament. The law and the prophets are the basis, the foundation of practice. It's what we use. It's also the law and the prophets, if you look it up. It's many times the reference where it is spoken, I am spoken of, Jesus said, in the law and the prophets. They speak of me. So they are foundational in what we do and why we believe that Jesus is the Messiah. It's used quite often. It's the basis of our conduct. In the Old Testament, it's Leviticus 19:18. Neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. To love your neighbor as you would love you. The New Testament tells us that really, truly, people don't hate themselves. They love themselves and they want to be loved by other people. Therefore, if you want to be treated with mercy, what should you do? Be merciful. If you want to be treated with justice, and you want justice, be just. If you want to be loved by other people, you've got to love them. That sounds soapy, it sounds soppy. I didn't write it. It's in your Bible. Love your neighbor as yourself. Do unto others whatever you want men to do, do that to other people. For that is the law and the prophets, and we therefore fulfill the law. Brethren, if indeed, and I believe the church teaches the truth, if indeed the end be 10 years away, 25 years away, or 50, pick a number. I've got no clue. But the end will come. This church prophesies out of God's word that it will end one day. It will. And this will all change. But if that's the case, God's people, as we heard in the first message, and we heard in the prayer, God's people need to be seen as people resolute in the practices that we have just read. Understanding, kind, compassionate, with mercy, in justice. We of all people on the earth, God's people, if that's who we claim to obey, we of all people should know and should realize these things. These are young people. Those of you that are young, I don't know what's young, 30, under 30, under 25, I don't know. Young people, these are your good old days. When you hear about us old folks, I know, it sticks in the throat, doesn't it? Speak about the good old days. We were your age. You are now living your good old days. I believe that there will come a time when we will pray for these days. As bad as they are, these days will look mighty good. Mighty good. And that is what is prophesied. And we of all people, as events, we know as events overtake us. And I'm sorry, I love this nation. I put my flag out on those special days. God will not save America. He will not protect America forever. The church has taught that for 80 years. God will not forever protect America. But God will always, and promises that he will always protect his people, those that are called according to his name. And so we need to realize that. And as times get more and more difficult, we also all want to see clearly. All of us want to see clearly. There's many of us in this room that have glasses on. It's a very hard and factual reality that one day the cheaters from the 99-cent store just aren't going to cut it any longer. And we have to get glasses. I mean, I hate these things. I lose them. I drop them off the bed. Then I get out of the bed, and guess what I do? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I step on them. And then I got to go to the Costco guy and say, you did it again? I can't stand these things, but I have to have them because I have trouble seeing without them, and many of you will understand. So physical vision is important. It's critical if we want to function physically. But spiritual vision, seeing clearly, says we need to always be looking to remove this out of this. Physical to physical, but with a spiritual overtone. Spiritual vision is what we want. But it is your vision. It's your beam and my beam. It's your eye and my eye that the log must be removed from. It's not so much what we say, but it's often so much what we do. And we all want to see clearly. What do I see? I see my brethren.